welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the writer and podcaster, Lisa Schmeiser. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
It is such a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. And I'm looking forward to this one because this is one of those cases where I actually know nothing. And I mean absolutely nothing other than what I have quickly looked up on Wikipedia this morning about what you're going to talk about. So please tell us what you've come on the show to talk about and give us some context around, well, the whole thing, really, and why it is maligned or possibly in this case overlooked. And then, you know, why you think that is wrong.
I'm here to talk about the TV show Andromeda, which ran in the States and in Canada from October 2000 to May 2005. It's a show that was, the premise was found in Gene Roddenberry's notes, and the creative team kind of went from there. And long story short, it's basically Kevin Sorbo goes to space. And over the course of 5 years on the show, they reboot several characters more than once. They change the premise of the show midstream. It devolves into lunacy through the whole last season. But it's almost compulsively watchable because the writers just keep experimenting with different ideas and they throw things out there to make it stick. And there are some really interesting narrative premises that remain consistent all the way through. So it's kind of schlocky. The writing is wildly inconsistent, but the sheer boldness and experimentation and Kevin Sorbo's full-out commitment to his role as a heroic space captain. Like, this guy just goes in 110%. It makes it almost compulsively watchable. The real tragedy is that you can't watch it on Netflix. You can't watch it on iTunes. You can't watch it on Amazon. I did find a DVD set for the entire series available, but it's for $100, which is a huge bet to take on a show you've never seen. So Andromeda is one of those shows that's entertaining, and unless it's airing on late night cable at some point, you will probably, or unless you go hunting through file exchange sites, you're probably never going to see it.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. I'm not sure if this even ran in the UK, at least on sort of regular mainstream channels. It may well run now at sort of 11 p.m. on some obscure digital-only channel, but
yes.
as what we think of as mainstream channels here in the UK, which do show, you know, and having the past shown things like Star Trek and Buffy and, you know, Supernatural and genre shows like that. But I don't recall this ever being shown in the UK. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I'm not a huge Trekkie. So, so the fact that this was linked to Roddenberry interests me, but not enough that I would have made an enormous effort to watch it if it had been shown.
I think because the show was also syndicated, which means that you have a production company that created and underwrote it, and then they sold it to individual stations or individual businesses that run stations. I think that may have accounted for the show not building up much of an audience, because I remember finding it purely by happenstance and getting sucked in. Because you have a cast, to backtrack a little bit, you have a cast, which Kevin Sorbo is your square-jawed space captain. His second-in-command, for lack of a better word, is actually a android avatar of his ship. Because he was the captain of a warship, and the warship's AI, artificial intelligence, is so powerful and so immense and so sophisticated that it was able to create an android for itself. So the captain could have walk and talks with the AI. He doesn't have to be sitting at a computer. he doesn't have to be sitting at a computer the whole time. She's basically a mobile version. You know, she's not Data from Star Trek The Next Generation, because Data, you know, is just an android who's pretty much limited. He's a self-contained being. She's, I would say, think of her almost as a mobile phone that's connected to a computer.
Right.
except she's wearing skin-tight leather, because science fiction. And,
well, and I was just going to say, you said she, so this was a female sort of, you know, number two star.
Yes, so you have the captain and you have the AI of the ship. And one of the reasons I kept watching this show is because it was a really tidy inversion of the cliche where typically a ship captain is in love with his ship. You know, you saw the fierce devotion that Captain Picard has to the Enterprise. And right around the turn of the millennium, we had two different shows which actually posited the reverse, that the ship could be in love with its captain or a ship could be in love with its inhabitants. The first and infinitely superior show I'm talking about is Farscape, where you do have pilot tapped into the living ship Moya, and that ship was more like an ecosystem. The pilot and the ship were a symbiotic organism that worked in concert with the crew. But then you also have Andromeda, where it's plainly evident through much of the series that the ship's AI is blindingly in love with her captain. And that is, of course, there's a lot of long, lingering looks and very awkward moments and poignant ends to episodes and things like that. But it was I liked that they reversed the convention like that.
There you are. I've been looking for you.
Dylan, I want to be dismantled. You should get rid of this body. Chop it up into pieces and throw it out of the airlock, or better yet, erase me. Just delete everything and start all over again.
I'm not gonna do that.
I killed him, Dylan. I loved him and I killed him.
You had no choice.
No, I didn't. Because I'm a warship. And warships only know how to do one thing, and that's kill. We don't have hearts. We don't have empathy. We're killers. We're attack dogs. And I'm afraid. The Bounds of Judgment went insane. The Pax Magellanic went insane, and I don't want that to happen to me.
You're forgetting something. The Bounds of Judgment had no captain, no crew. The Pax lost her captain. Why do you think warships have captains in the first place? I'm your heart, Rami. I always will be.
These physical reactions. I didn't know Harper was so good.
The Commonwealth needs you, Andromeda. The crew needs you. I need you. So, permission to chop yourself into pieces is officially denied.
It's kind of cheesy aesthetics because syndicated budget is much, much different from a network or a network underwritten budget or even a sci-fi channel written budget. And you have this pair, the captain and his spaceship, and they're in the middle of a war, of course, and they get caught on the event horizon of a black hole where they are frozen in space and time for 300 years. And they are finally brought back to life, you know, at the end of a couple centuries by a motley crew of scavengers. And in that 300 year period, civilization has ostensibly fallen. And so Kevin Sorbo then turns himself into the world's most dedicated retro bureaucrat because he's determined to bring back the government that he helped support. And he's supposed to do this just with the aid of his AI, who's in love with him. This strapping bodybuilder who is a member of a race called the Nietzscheans. The way that the writers wrote this was, oh, they all read Nietzsche. They're all Ubermenches. And it's an insane culture, which I'm happy to get into in a little bit. And then two Earthlings who are space scavengers / hackers. A creature who it's a female creature, so again, spandex because sci-fi. So you have another cast member who looks like she should be fresh out of like Japanese anime because she's purple and she's got a long tail and she's adorable and squeals a lot. And then you find out like they reboot her character a couple years down the series, and you find out she's actually the living avatar of an actual son.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're just, after a while you're just like, oh, okay. And then the last one was basically a 4 foot tall bat man, a man with the face of a bat, who is the member of an extremely murderous species that reproduced by capturing humans and laying eggs in them. So you have this motley crew, and clearly the whole premise was supposed to be it's a clash of civilizations, it's a clash of beliefs. Can these people learn to work together and unite towards a common goal, and will they learn lessons, and will they succeed? That's where this show started, and it began to go sideways by the end of the first season. And it was just the next 4 years are just fascinating watching it skid all over the place because like I said, the character who starts off looking like she belongs in a Japanese cartoon, her name was Trans Gemini. There's some sort of time travel antic that takes place at the end of season two. And one of the characters, the lead space scavenger, runs into her older self, and her older self is like lost an eye and turned into this really grizzled, awful space pirate. And then, the Trans Gemini character, who is purple this time, runs into an orange version of herself. And the orange version looks like Tina Turner from the Mad Max movies, like the full on hair, the costume and everything. And they have this very cryptic conversation, and there's like a big clap and a flash of light. And then boom, the orange character stays, the purple character goes, and she's still very mysterious. And then she drops more clues. And then she's like, oh, and by the way, I'm not really human. I'm the projection of a star that's dreaming. And this star is trapped in combat with this abyss that the bat people worship. And I'm in danger of being dragged into the abyss. And so I'm working with the bat people. And I was like, when I was watching, I was like, there are like six different ideas going on here. And any one of them would have made a story, but the writers just kept throwing more and more and more at it. And while that's going on, you know, you got the humans scrambling around, and then the Nietzschean dude manages to have a secret child with someone. This secret child is a perfect genetic replica of somebody who founded the entire Nietzschean species. There's skullduggery involving stolen infants. He betrays the team like approximately 300 times before they finally kick him off the show. But at this point, another one of the space scavengers is somehow flung back in time to become the founding mother of the race of Nietzscheans, and no one believes her. And between the time travel, rebooting of people's characters, changing their motivations, massive ideological questions thrown out there, such as, should we allow a race of aliens that survive by laying their eggs in other people? Is it good to allow them into space? Kevin Sorbo constantly being asked to justify this government he wants to bring back to everybody. And then the issue of how human, or rather how sentient or how independent are AIs anyway? There are about eight different shows going on in this show, all at the same time.
I finished sorting the Maru's records.
And?
I did locate 17 different accounts of the Battle of Witch Head. All of them are quite consistent. The Nietzschean fleet was comprised of 500 ships, no more.
Well, then how do you explain those extra ships?
We must have changed history. Something we did influenced the timeline.
Or something we will do
before the battle.
Which, according to my analysis, is in less than 4 hours.
Harper's device.
Fusion catalyst. These records are right. The only way we can preserve history, prevent the rise of a Nietzschean empire, and ensure that our timeline remains intact, is to destroy over 1,000 Nietzschean ships.
May I?
I'd like to be alone for a while, if you don't mind.
I understand. I myself prefer solitude while doing mathematics.
How do you know?
Oh, it wasn't difficult. In fact, I suspect I could guess the equation. Let me see. 1,000 ships. Average crew size, 100. Simple multiplication.
100,000 people. How can I even consider it?
Dylan, fate brought you to this battle. Destiny demands your actions. I know this is not easy for you, but perhaps you are merely a tool of divine will.
That's a nice excuse. Humans have been using it since the dawn of time. I had to kill my enemies. It's what God wanted.
Just because humans use it as an excuse does not negate the possibility.
What kind of divine plan requires the deaths of tens of thousands of people?
It sounds absolutely bonkers.
It is. It is. And I used to. It is the perfect. It was the perfect show. Imagine you've gone out on a Friday night. You've had a few. You know, you wake up about 1 o'clock the next afternoon, and you stumble to the couch and you're eating a bowl of cereal and you just want something to watch. This was perfect for that, because you could just kind of, what?
Literally space out. Yeah.
Yes. And
oh, man.
But it worked because the actors had such straight-faced commitment to it. Like, there was not a single hint of irony on the show. It was possibly...
Oh, right, all played completely straight.
Yes, everybody played it completely straight, no matter how ridiculous the plot twist. Everybody played it with total commitment, and the show took itself incredibly seriously as well. Each episode would start off with a made-up quote from like a Nietzschean philosopher or from some long-dead bureaucrat, and it would be some fortune cookie-like aphorism on the fickle nature of humanity or the fickle nature of another space species or how awful love is or something.
So the quotes, they weren't real. They were fictional quotes.
They were fictional, oh, yes, meant to add color and to try to give you a hint of exactly what kind of civilization right. Dylan was fighting to restore. Wow. And the quote also foreshadowed the theme or the major plot of the episode. And
of course it did. I mean, that's the sort of thing that I expect to see in a Warhammer 40,000 rule book, you know, not on a primetime TV show.
It was baffling because the writers did a great job. The writing room did a great job of trying to build out this world. They had all these fake quotes, and I tracked them for a little bit. Again, this is back from 2000 to 2005. I tracked them for a little bit because I was curious to see if they would go back to the same, you know, sages consistently, or if they would throw in, you know, maybe a quote from Groucho Marx and attribute it to unknown, lost in civilization, or something like that. But they built out this backstory. They built out a couple complex cultures that are, you know, not Earth-based. They build out this technology, the AI technology, because they think that through very carefully. They devised a method for the spaceship to be able to travel faster than light. And then they just kept yanking the show in like 8 different directions within the sandbox. It was like being on a lunatic Dungeons & Dragons campaign.
Do you think that was, I mean, there's so much here that I want to unpack and get into.
Yes,
but
yes.
Do you think that rapid sort of push and pull and changing of directions of the shows and stuff, was that network interference or...
They had,
or what?
I know they had some turbulence behind the scenes. I believe that they cycled through a few writers and a few different head writers and a few different showrunners.
So it may have been a case of somebody coming in and throwing out the previous yes. guy's favorite stuff.
Exactly. And then season 5 was the only season to be adapted by the Sci-Fi Network. And I can't back this up with specific citations, but my impression has always been that the Sci-Fi Network is really not shy about passing on notes and giving you very clear directions where they want the show to go.
Right, right.
And so that would explain why in season 5, Dylan displayed previously heretofore unknown powers of telekinesis.
Wait, this is the captain character?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Because previously before you had found out that he had not grown up on Earth. He'd grown up on a mining planet, and as such, he had been he and the other citizens of the planet had been genetically enhanced to handle lower gravity. So, whenever he was in ship's gravity or on an Earth level gravity, he was of course stronger.
Super strong, right? Right.
He was super strong and super fast. And part of me is like, did Kevin Sorbo have that written into the contract so he could flex his muscles?
get his top off occasionally. Yeah.
Oh, there were always lots of sparring scenes where he'd be in like a tank top with the hair flopping everywhere. And
well, when you've got a handsome man like Kevin Sorbo, why not? And yeah, he looks like a square-jawed galactic space hero.
He really does. And this was fresh off Hercules, so he had had practice.
Oh, so he was still ripped.
Yes, and he had had 7 years of staring off into the middle distance and looking purposeful to draw on. They cut his hair into something that looks like Barry Gibbs from the 1970s. And
oh, man.
And he's just very, you know, he's very purposeful and I would imagine if you were to make a really low budget X-Men movie, like he would play Scott Summers. So that is basically the Dylan character, except without the concussive eye beams. And
you talking about budget, you mentioned that it was a sort of, you know, it had budget aesthetics, low budget aesthetics. But do you think was that compared to even to other shows of the time, or is that just because we are talking a fairly long time ago? This would have been
this was 15 years ago.
Yeah,
started.
It would have been funnily enough around the same time of just sort of post X-Files and
and the dwindling down of Deep Space Nine. Voyager was still going on
pre-Battlestar Galactica relaunch.
Yes.
So, you know, we are in that kind of Trek era of TV sci-fi level, you know, effects and aesthetics.
The effects and aesthetics would have been great in the 1980s. They do a lot of really great work with makeup. They do a lot of really great work with costuming and with blocking and staging so that normal-sized actors looked either very tall or very small.
Right.
You know, where it falls down were giant cosmic special effects, just because they simply didn't have the processor power that other shows around the same time would have had. And I think it's fair to note that science fiction shows around the turn of the millennium had a huge challenge anyway, because they were being produced and put on TV the same time that The Matrix had just hit U.S. theaters.
Yes, of course.
And I don't know if my perception is shared by a lot of moviegoers, but I remember the first time I watched that movie, I thought, this is an entirely new visual vocabulary.
I think everybody shared that feeling. Yeah, The Matrix,
yes. Okay, good.
You only have to look at every movie made in the 5 years that came after The Matrix to see the massive influence it had. It just completely changed the game. As I discussed actually with Jason Snell on the very first episode of this show, much in the same way that Battlestar Galactica changed the visual vocabulary for TV science fiction.
Yes, I would agree with that too. And but you had Matrix going on in the theaters, and then you'd come and the effects on the small screen seemed comparatively hokey.
Right.
Because shows hadn't yet figured out how to work to their strengths and their advantages. You know, the smaller, like, you had TV shows tend to do really well if they can capitalize on the smaller feeling screen, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons The X-Files and Twin Peaks, both of them remain really visually compelling shows from the early 90s, is because they both capitalized on a sense of claustrophobia and a sense that there was something right outside your vision that you didn't know was there.
Right.
Or that you couldn't see was there. Like, you had the feeling it was there, you couldn't see it.
Rather than big, wide expanse, yeah.
Exactly. And the challenge of a space show is you are floating through the void. So how do you depict that in a way that's visually plausible?
Well, and even mentioning it again, even Battlestar Galactica traded on a feeling of paranoia and claustrophobia, even though that was set in space, because most of it took place, of course, on board the ships, which were very, you know, sort of dark and claustrophobic.
Yes.
Talking about the... That reminds me, one of the things that I thought when I looked this up before we started talking on the show was the crew. I mean, the way you've described them to me is actually quite different to the impression I'd gotten looking this up on places like Wikipedia. But I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but it really brought to mind Firefly.
Yes.
Which, of course, launched after this, so it would have been, you know, not accusing this of copying Firefly, but...
No, it's a really compelling premise to have a clash of cultures within a crew. Because if you remember, Voyager launches that way, where you have the Starfleet ship that gets flung into the Delta Quadrant along with the ship full of Maquis or Rebels, and Captain Janeway's big challenge is how does she meld these two groups of people with very different motivations. How does she unite them under a common purpose? And so that's a theme that I think a lot of writers will cleave to, because there's a lot of dramatic potential in conflict. There's a lot of dramatic potential in culture clashes. There's a lot of meat to sink your teeth into over which value is better, and you know, how do you argue for or against? So I can see where that trope gets repeated over and over and over again. Yeah, here it's just very stark.
But the other thing I was thinking of was that they were described as a salvage crew.
Yes.
And while Firefly isn't a salvage crew, they are, you know, sort of traders and gunslingers. And, you know, they're not actually military personnel in the way that even in Voyager, you know, they were still members of Starfleet. Even the Rebels were rebels within a sort of ship-faring culture. Whereas this sounds much more like a ragtag band of, you know, of people, much like Firefly.
I think the composition of the crew was supposed to symbolize how far civilization had fallen, because on the one hand you have Captain Dylan Hunt, and also Dylan is the most 1990s name you can think of.
Yes, it is.
So on the one hand you have Captain Dylan Hunt and the Andromeda. We'll just refer to her as Rami because that's what he called the android. So you have Captain Dylan Hunt and Rami on the side of civilization and structure, and the almost and the classical Roddenberry-esque, in the future, a science and evidence-based civilization of tolerance will spread out and colonize the stars. Like, he's almost an avatar of classic Roddenberry values. And then you have the self-interested Nietzschean, and then you have the missionary, and then you have this group of human scavengers, and it's made pretty clear from early on that the humans have drifted to the low end of the hierarchy in terms of which races are dominating space and civilization. And Dylan sees this, and he's like, well, of course we have to return things to the way they were 300 years ago. This is where the show consistently failed to make a case that this was necessary. Because I love a good post-fall of civilization type disaster narrative. I stuck with the show Defiance for all 3 years because I really liked the idea of forming civilization from post-war chaos.
Right.
And so I was intrigued by that here because there are a lot of stories you can tell about the fall of civilization or how people deal with losing an infrastructure or how people try to preserve the dim flicker of culture or what have you. But even in this prolapsarian state, there are still these comprehensive databases aboard the scavenger ship, which tags along with Andromeda, called the Eureka Maru. There are still these comprehensive databases that have all sorts of up-to-date pertinent information on every species and culture they need to know about. And they still have a widespread communication system that stretches across 3 different galaxies. And there is healthy trade and commerce with rules that are enforced. And there's organized sports leagues and there's organized religion. So
it's not exactly anarchy, is it?
No. And I thought to myself, at one point I remember watching this and thinking, this dude is on a quest that would be roughly akin to having somebody wake up from the 1700s and say, all right, USA, you've had your fun, but I think it's time for you to rejoin the British Empire. And there's a compelling case to be made for that for many reasons, I would add. But at the same time, no, we've kind of moved in a different direction and it's benefiting a lot of people. The one thing the show never really adequately addresses is the current universe, the one that Dylan wakes up in. For all that, you know, the megacracy using Earth as a breeding ground, or for all that, it's a remarkably pluralistic universe. I mean, there's space for more than one civilization to comfortably roam around. And if there are occasional skirmishes between civilizations, it doesn't wipe out an entire culture. And I never got a sense of whether or not the Commonwealth was equally pluralistic or if it was more monoculture. And I suspect the writers either didn't know or they weren't going to say either way, because if it was like, oh, in the past, everyone did the same thing and had the same values and ate the same thing and it was great, and then you'd have people like, no.
Right, saying, no, that's not so great. But on the other hand, if it was equally pluralistic, then you might have viewers saying, well, then what's the difference?
Yes, and that was one of the core problems of the show is Dylan kept trying to restore a civilization, and there were no visible benefits to anyone for doing so.
Dylan! Sabotage!
Sabotage.
Captain, the starboard engines are offline.
Rotate ship to come.
Commander?
Ready!
I tried to warn you.
What are you doing?
Ensuring the survival of my people. The Commonwealth is weak. It bargains with its enemies. It compromises. My people are engineered to be perfect. And the Commonwealth is no place for the strong.
So Anichans decided to destroy it.
We've spent years preparing, waiting, arguing. For a long time, I opposed the destruction of the system's Commonwealth. So did many others.
The Treaty of Antares changed all that.
The Magog!
Yes! The Magog! Savages. Predators. They eat sentient beings. They reproduce by rape. They killed over 1 billion people on Brandenburg Tor. They destroyed the Nietzschean colony on Hawking. And what did the Commonwealth do?
We made peace with them.
You compromised with monsters. The blood of over 1 billion people cried out for vengeance. And you made peace. You have sown the wind. You shall reap the whirlwind.
The whole Nietzschean thing, that does sound very Trek. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, they're sort
yes.
of, that character is out for himself. But from what I read, the whole premise of those sort of people is that they...
They
base
warlike.
Themselves on Nietzsche's, you know, Übermensch statements, and it probably mistakenly, but and that they literally think that they are superior to everybody else, which seems, the fact that they're the bad guys seems a very Trek thing, you know. Yes. This idea that actually everybody, you know, should be equal and just get along, and that people who think they're superior to others are the bad guys.
If the way that Nietzscheans were consistently portrayed, just imagine a group of very attractive bodybuilders, all of whom had taken doctorates in English literature. Because they had a remarkable history of oral tradition, and just to give you an idea of what you're dealing with here, the Nietzschean who is part of the Andromeda crew is introduced as Tyr Anasazi of Kodiak Pride, out of Victoria by Barbarossa. And if you unpack that culturally speaking, Tyr is one of the Norse gods. Anasazi is another, you know, fairly fierce culture. Kodiak, of course, refers to a giant bear. Victoria could be an allusion to Queen Victoria, you know, since she was arguably one of the most effective monarchs of the last several hundred years. You know, she did a remarkable job expanding an empire. And then Barbarossa was another famous feared warrior king. Mm-hmm. And all of the Nietzscheans have names like this, where they sometimes go to Roman influences or Greek influences or whatever, and they're relentlessly hierarchical. And like you said, it is antithetical to Gene Roddenberry's general ethos of, oh, all we need is some federation or some commonwealth that gives everybody equal resources and equal opportunity, and we'll have some kind of egalitarian nirvana. So it does raise an uncomfortable question about, you know, what the role of excellence might be, or how you would define it even.
Right. Well, and that's always been the biggest sort of question about Trek itself, hasn't it? Is like, you know, well, what happens to people who are exceptional? Of course, in Trek, the answer is, well, they join Starfleet, because everybody joins Starfleet.
And they're cheerful about, oh, I'll just use my exceptional skills in the service of the Enterprise, or I'll use my exceptional skills in the service of Starfleet, or... because why wouldn't I? It's like the exact opposite of Ayn Rand.
Right.
If it were an Ayn Randian universe, all these exceptional people go off on their own planet and leave me alone. I'm creating beautiful things.
So let's go back to the origins of this then, because that's obviously all about Gene Roddenberry. So This was made almost a decade after his death from an original concept that was found in his notes, I guess.
That is what Nigel Roddenberry says, and I think that was the story she was sticking to.
Right. Well, I was going to say, has anybody seen those notes? Have they been published? Do we know how close this is to his original idea?
I don't know. I would have loved to have seen them, because I'm curious. When you look through Internet Apocrypha on this series, there are things that stand out. For example, the character who they reboot at the end of season 2, who turns out to be the living avatar of a star, Roddenberry had specifically named her Trance Gemini, and then added that, it's because she was a star dreaming she was a person. And so he's like, the clue was always in her name all along. But there's actually a short story that one of the writers wrote and stuck out on the internet that has a completely different origin story and future for her. So I get the feeling that Nigel Roddenberry slapped down a pile of notes. Some people nodded and said, yes, some of these ideals are recognizably Roddenberry-esque, and they ran with it.
Fair enough.
What fascinates me about this is... I remember with both Star Trek and Star Trek The Next Generation, Roddenberry was very emphatic that they had moved to a post-currency, post-religious culture. And he began to backtrack on that a bit with Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating, because this is the first Roddenberry-esque show I can think of. And again, I want to stress, I'm not nearly so fluent in Deep Space Nine, and I know that religion does affect several of the characters. I did a... Random Trek episode with Scott McNulty where religion and shrines played a role. But this is the first one that starts off with just a straight out, there are prophecies, there are forces that are bigger than, there are forces that are bigger and incomprehensible to humanity, and these forces do take an interest in human affairs and meddle with them frequently. And to the best of my knowledge, that's like the first time that a religious entity in a Roddenberry created world hasn't been able to be easily explained by aliens did it, or or which was something that happened on Deep Space Nine, where it was aliens did it, or, you know, it was codified culture, or there was technology, or what does God need with a spaceship? So, because here you do have legitimate, there's something called the Abyss, which is this all-devouring malevolent entity that the crew repeatedly faces off against every 5 years. And that fascinates me, that either he started to monkey around with the notion of religion pushing, pulling, affecting this egalitarian technotopia, or somebody got a hold of the notes and said, oh, you know what this needs? This needs a little hoodoo.
Yeah. A little woo-woo.
Exactly, yes.
You mentioned 5 years, and it ran for 5 series. That's not a bad run, really.
No.
I mean, it sounds like they were, from all the pushing and pulling, I'm going to guess that that's maybe because they were constantly on the verge of cancellation or something.
Yes.
But even so, 5 years is nothing to scoff at. You know, the X-Files didn't run for much longer.
No, and Star Trek The Next Generation, I think, only ran for 7.
Right.
So it's, and that's another reason I wanted to talk about Andromeda, is because, you know, if you do put together a show for half a decade and you do throw out a lot of very interesting ideas, what happens when the ship is in love with her captain, for example? And Rami's a warship. She was designed to vaporize planets. And they do have conversations about when it's appropriate to do that. And she does have conversations about how it's in her personality to do that. There are so many good ideas in this series, and there are some very good performances, and it just flies below the radar for people. You don't find a lot of folks who are willing to say, you know what show I really enjoyed watching, or you know what show I did reliably tune in for? I tuned in for Andromeda. Like, I've run into far, far more people who love and still passionately talk about Farscape, which was just a 4-season series.
Right.
Than I have over this.
And also, I mean, Farscape, by all accounts, an even stranger series than this.
You know, yes and no. And I say this as somebody who also really loves Farscape. Do you remember, if we rewind our conversation a little, when we talk about the challenge of shooting a spacefaring series on TV?
Mm-hmm.
Because of their genius decision to make the ship a living entity, and to have people and to have the crew rattle around in what was effectively another living creature, they do a lot of great interior work.
Right.
And when they go off ship to a planet or something, they're almost always in a bar. So
oh, it really is Firefly.
Yeah, so they do well. And
so this is more overlooked than anything, then, is what you're saying. Again, thinking back to the very first episode where Jason and I talked about Stargate, his argument there was that Stargate has been almost erased from the discussion about sci-fi on TV, because it was sort of right on the cusp of that step change that came with Battlestar Galactica. And do you think that you would say this falls into more or less the same category then?
I do. I also think we need to take a look at the Joss Whedon influence, because one of the things that Firefly excelled at was a really rousing sense of humanity. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the zippy dialogue, you know, the classic Whedon-esque dialogue. All of the characters had... there were no 100% good, 100% bad characters. So you had these very complex characters with very complex motivations who were still capable of relating to each other on multiple levels and cracking wise. And Andromeda happened right before that. So
right. And did it not have much of that then?
No, it was very Roddenberry-esque in the sense that all of the characters had their dominant characteristics. And so you could basically predict how any of them were going to act in a given scene.
Right.
You know, you could rely on Dylan to be, you know, upstanding and idealistic and pragmatic all at once. And you could rely on the Nietzschean to be self-interested. And
presumably they were all played in a very sincere fashion as well. That's something
that
really marks out sort of 90s era Trek.
Mm-hmm. Because you think about the complete commitment that Jonathan Frakes and Michael Dorn bring to their characters.
Well, and even the very little that I've seen of Voyager and Deep Space Nine, everybody is so thoroughly sincere.
Yes. There's no irony in a Roddenberry universe.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, Bill Maher's proclamations to the contrary, I think that in the middle of the last decade, again, with the advent of Battlestar Galactica, with Joss Whedon's fingerprints all over several shows on several different networks, situational irony became something that people began to want, because it tends to reflect the way that people look at their own lives or situations that unfold. And so having a show full of incredibly sincere people who come together in the face of odds and persevere seemed a little bit quaint.
Quaint is a really good way of putting it, yeah. And that's a term with obviously some very pejorative connotations behind it, but you know, without meaning it as an insult, yeah, that's exactly how I think of sort of 90s era Trek, is that it is quaint, even more so in a way than 60s era Trek, because 60s era Trek you look at and you're like, well, okay, this is really cheap and sort of old fashioned, but it's innovative for its time. Whereas 90s Trek wasn't really innovative. It was good. Yeah. I'm not knocking it, but it wasn't really innovative. But it was, yeah, you're looking back and you're like, wow, that's really kind of, you know, idealistic in a good way, but yeah, that is a very quaint attitude in our now.
It's earnest. It's very earnest.
Earnest, yes, in our post-millennial, post-modern culture.
Now, I ended up rewatching the entire series run way back when I was on maternity leave, and what struck me, well, two things, which are one, Patrick, it is no wonder that everyone loves Patrick Stewart, because that role made him.
Oh, sure. Well, and he made that role.
Oh, my God, yeah. It's amazing what he does in it. Because he brings a lot of twinkle and depth, and I have a feeling that if he had been given his head more often, it would be, there would be a little bit more reflexive humor.
Right.
Because if you take a look at how he plays Charles Xavier in the X-Men movies, which are in their own way equally earnest, he still plays them with a little bit of this is kind of a ridiculous situation. It's ridiculous that I'm the world's most powerful mutant. I'm stuck in a wheelchair. And, you know, there's a certain knowing twinkle in that role that I would have loved to have seen in Picard. This is similarly earnest and similarly formulaic. And as such, it's not something you're going to turn around your head over and over after you finish watching it.
Right.
And one of the reasons I keep contrasting it to Farscape is, again, Farscape was on at roughly the same time, but it did have, I would say almost a proto-Whedon-esque, almost self-awareness, because the American cowboy astronaut who gets rocketed into the farthest reaches of space and is now dealing with a bunch of aliens, his first reflex is always smartassery. And it was very unlike anything the Trek universe would have done that way.
Right, well, and that leads us into, because we're heading towards, we are talking now about Trek and Roddenberry, and one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, do you think that this would have worked better? Or equally, or that it even might have been worse if it had been, you know, sort of changed and modified to fit within the Trek universe, to be a Trek series, in the way that something like Deep Space Nine was not in any sense traditional Star Trek, but they made it fit within the Star Trek universe.
I should start by saying one of the reasons I like Deep Space Nine and have come back to it, because I actually didn't have a TV for many years, and many of those years coincided with Deep Space Nine. but one of the things I was fascinated by, and this goes back to my love of chaos narrative, is Deep Space Nine is about frontiers. It's the same reason I really liked the TV show Babylon 5, is because it's a bit like the Monty Python sketch. Well, first we built the castle and then it sank, and then we built the castle and it caught on fire, and then we built the castle, it caught on fire, and then it sank. And with Babylon 5, it was like, oh, you know, sure, a couple of these have disappeared, but we think this one's going to stick. And that was the frontier outpost. What happens when cultures come together? Do you preserve the civilizations you come from, or do you create a new one? And Deep Space Nine did the same thing with, do you preserve the civilizations you come from, or do you find a new way forward? I honestly don't know where or how this would have fit, because I think in order to make it fit into the Trek universe as we understand it, you would have had to have flung it forward several centuries, long enough where the fall of the Federation would have given viewers a sense of substantial loss, but not so close to the current series where viewers can despair for how hard their favorite people have worked because it's all going to go away.
Right, right. I see that, yeah.
Deep Space Nine and The Next Generation had such extraordinary goodwill, and both of them were about building and extending civilization, you know, either finding ways to make it work or about extending the message of Starfleet far and wide. And I think if Andromeda had been just like 50 years later, we're in a violent fight and civilization's on the verge of collapse, everyone would have been like, but how does Picard feel about this?
Right, right. You run the risk of looking back at those other series and thinking, well, yeah, you know, realizing that it's too close, as you say. Yeah.
This is all for nothing. Yeah, yeah. So you would have had to throw it several hundred to 1,000 years in the future.
At which point it then becomes unrecognizable anyway.
Yes. And yeah. Then you also have continuity problems, because exactly how do the Nishians arise and have this really long history when there are Klingons and Romulans who have similar honor-based culture and similar traditions? And you'd also be asking other questions like, where are the Borg in all of this? Why is Starfleet so comfortable with having living avatars, you know?
I guess I was thinking that maybe you could substitute, you know, Romulans for the Nietzsches or something like that.
You probably could substitute, I would say, Klingons.
Right, but it sounds like you'd have to do a lot more massaging than maybe I was anticipating.
Yeah.
How did it go down with Trekkies, though, in general? Because given that it's a Roddenberry property, as it were, you know, and a Roddenberry concept.
I never found that many people who watch Star Trek who watched this. And I suspect the reason is that you have a lot of Trekkers, I think they like to be called, who have much better taste than I do.
I'm sorry if I've offended any Trekkers or Trekkies by saying that. I thought that Trekkies had become sort of, I thought they'd taken it back, you know, reclaimed it.
I think so. bear in mind, I'm also going off of knowledge that's 25 years old. One of my first professional assignments was a Star Trek convention, and I was schooled very carefully on how you refer to them as Trekkers and not Trekkies.
Ah, I see.
So I don't know how many Trekkers, Trekkies, how many fans of Star Trek, let's call them that.
Excellent.
I don't know how many of them have my enthusiasm for schlock. I'm also thinking I actually sat through a season of Cleopatra 2525 to see what that was about.
Wow.
Yes. I will watch. I gave a lot of shows. I am always fascinated. I like John Waters films too. I'm always fascinated by people's vigorous aesthetic and thematic commitments to
schlock.
Yes, exactly. Like, I'm fascinated by people who go in 100% on that. And it's just, especially if it's just this really coherent experience. And Andromeda is a bit schlocky. You know, the sincerity is a little bit tin pot because the writing is all over the place. There's a lack of focus that I think would have driven Star Trekkers nuts, because one of the things that I think attracts Trekkers is how well thought out and consistent that universe tends to be.
Right.
And how quickly anomalies are explained or disappeared.
Whereas here it seems like half the show was built around anomalies.
Oh my gosh.
Well, reboots and revamps.
Yes, they just keep changing things on the show. And in a way that you don't see in other Roddenberry shows, because again, you know, Picard is wonderfully consistent through 7 years. There may be incremental character growth, like Worf grows over the course of the 7 years of The Next Generation. And then you see more personal growth through Deep Space Nine, but it's not nearly so dramatic as, oh, and by the way, I'm the living avatar of a solar body.
Right. Yeah. We don't start a new season and suddenly he's a completely different character. Yeah.
Although one thing that I do find kind of anomalous is, you did have the rise of the Borg in the Trek universe. And I always found it interesting that the Borg kind of arose as a bad guy at the same time that more and more people were getting online.
Oh, I'm sure that was not a coincidence, yeah.
But they had a really tortured relationship with erasing the boundaries between humanity and technology. You know, because that was the whole point of the conflict with the Borg is, oh, you lose your free will, you lose your autonomy, you don't gain anything in return. It's just this giant collective intelligence. And on Andromeda, you know, again, one of the protagonists is an android, or I should say one of the protagonists is an AI who is contained in a ship, can interface with the characters via android, or she can pop up on screens if they're at a computer.
And it sounds like it's never questioned at any point that this AI can feel emotion and can be in love with the captain.
Yes. And there's actually a really moving episode in the first season about another, they run across another warship. And in this case, the captain did engage in a physical affair with his AI and then dump her. And it makes the ship go crazy. Because what's interesting is, and one of the human characters, the techno hacker, who bafflingly knows very little about the warship, despite being fluent in all sorts of other technology, he has a data port installed in the back of his neck, so he can automatically jack into the ship, throw his brain into the computer, as it were, and he doesn't have to go to the trouble of typing or looking at screens. He turns into a cyborg, for lack of a better word. So this series was kind of fascinating to me in that it presented Donna Haraway's classic cyborg definition as a really positive thing. Like, it's great to have to blur the boundaries a bit. This makes technology more useful and comfortable for us, and it's better for humanity. And that's very, very different than how technology, artificial intelligence, and all that are generally treated in the Trek universe.
Well, and in a lot of sci-fi. I mean, it is by now a very, very tried and tested, sort of philosophy and plot device within science fiction that, sort of be careful what you build and, don't lose your humanity to, cyber limbs or the robots and artificial intelligence and all that. It's not that it's a bad area to cover, but it is something that has been covered a lot.
Extensively, really.
A lot. Yeah. And it is nice to see a sci-fi series or movies or read books where I'm thinking of, for example, Richard K. Morgan's.
Yes, The Mysteries. Yeah. Oh, what am I thinking?
Everybody has their intelligence uploaded to a central repository, and it's just a thing. It's just like having an iPhone or something. It's not, that is not what's a big deal about this universe. And it's nice sometimes to have a sci-fi universe where technology,
where they're like, it's no big deal.
Right. Where technology itself and, really highly advanced technology is not necessarily a bad thing.
Have you read David Mariusek?
I haven't, no.
Because that's something he does too, is the idea of discrete uploadable intelligence. You can download or upload your personality into different things.
Well, and they covered it on Battlestar Galactica to an extent as well, with the Cylons having the sort of their central personalities, downloading into new bodies from the what were they called? Not motherships.
I don't remember, to be honest with you.
Whatever they were called, anyway.
I desperately need to refresh on that series.
I haven't watched it since it was first on, but the main sort of motherships, in any case. Mm-hmm. It's nice sometimes to see technology presented in that way. And especially for a series that is, as you say, now 15 years old, because that feels like a more modern take as technology has become a much bigger part of our own lives.
In some ways, it really was. And to be frank, it almost predates the mobile phone era in that your mobile phone was a beautiful woman who wore leather.
I had a mobile phone in 2000. It definitely was not a beautiful woman.
Mine was like, it was one of those candy bar phones. It was terrible.
Size of a brick.
Yes. It's an atypical Roddenberry series in that religion plays a central role and not in an, this primitive backwater culture kind of way. Religion plays a central role, and technology augments and extends the human brain or the human experience is just seen as a matter of fact thing, as opposed to the who am I tortures that Data went through, or we have to fear the Borg because the Borg is a collective intelligence that's networked together of people. So in some ways it's radically un-Roddenberry-like, but the fact that your protagonist is very much in the Captain Kirk, Jean-Luc Picard, walking, talking standard of the bureaucracy of the prevailing power institution, and that you're supposed to sympathize with him. Like, that's classic Roddenberry.
A tall, athletic Caucasian man called Dylan Hunt who wants to restore a monarchy.
Yes.
That's your hero?
The show would almost be worth a revival now just because it would go well with the cultural conversations that we're having about privilege. Do people recognize when they have it? How do you exercise it? What are you not looking at? And to be fair, there are enough interactions on the show where the people who have grown up 300 years hence, you know, and have lived either as war refugees, which the human hacker child with the port in the back of his head did, or have spent their entire lives on a scavenging ship, you know, living on the edge of civilization, as the female lead did. They called Dylan out a lot on what he wants and what he presumes.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
So there's a nice back and forth on that.
This whole series sounds... I am actually now sad that I didn't watch it when it was on, because, I mean, it does sound like it was a bit bonkers in places, and maybe,
yes.
Maybe I would have been turned off by the constant shifting, but I don't know. There's something about it, certainly now, that sounds like I might have liked this.
I think so. It is a pity that you can't get it on any of the streaming services, because... I'm a huge fan of trying things out that way. It's a lower commitment. Mm. My brother was kind enough to give me a Netflix subscription for my birthday this year, and that's just been great for trying out series I wouldn't have tried otherwise. There was one I actually saw recently that came out of the UK. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It has to do with people leaving Earth and colonizing another planet. Jamie Bamber was in it for all of one episode.
Oh, really?
Yes, he gets killed off in the first episode. Which is very funny because the Netflix graphic has him front and center. You loved him in Battlestar Galactica.
Of course it does. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like those 1980s films where Brad Pitt was in it for 30 seconds. And,
yes.
You know, and you look at the DVD and it's just a massive Brad Pitt head.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, it's a shame that you can't easily find and try out Andromeda. But with luck, maybe there's DVDs available on eBay or somebody else has them somewhere. Or... you know, maybe there's a chance to write the production company. But yeah, this is sliding out of sci-fi memory, and it's too bad. A lot of the actors and actresses have gone on to continue to do more things. Lexa Doig was in Stargate, I believe, after this. Lexa Doig is the actress who plays Rami. Mm-hmm. So she's become a staple on the sci-fi network here in the U.S. And Kevin Sorbo's just gone off the deep end, so.
Right.
Yeah.
And speaking of the end, I think our time is up, so let's bring this to a close. But yeah, seriously, thank you, because like I say, I knew almost nothing about this series other than vaguely knowing the title, you know, that it existed.
Yes.
And now, as I say, in a way, I'm kind of sad that I never saw it, because it does sound absolutely bonkers.
It is. It was enjoyable.
All right, Lisa, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
I think the best place right now is on Twitter, and my handle is L Schmeiser. That's spelled L-S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R. And I am, of course, on The Incomparable on a fairly regular basis.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned, and please remember to check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com for information and links to all of my work. You can support the show by rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes, and if you really like it, please leave a review. It's the best way to spread the word to new listeners. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. For a minute there that you were going to mention Lex as one of the other.
Oh, that was another
examples.
One that was on around the same time.
That was
too.
Around the same time, wasn't it?
Oh, that show was lunatic. I used to watch
it. It was insane, wasn't it?
Oh, and they had that Robert Smith looking guy from I'm Dead and an Assassin. I haven't thought about that show in years, and I used to just watch that and I was like, what?
What is happening? What is going on? Yeah.
I am not stoned enough to appreciate this.
That TV show was called Outcasts, by the way.
Yes,
British,
that's the one.
The BBC
Thank you.
One,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was
yes.
A broadcast in BBC America in the States, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the fictional planet Carpathia. Oh, very similar.
Yes. Yes.
Ah, Jamie Bamber. I think he's been killed off in every British show that he's been in.
Yeah. Yes. This is, yeah. I don't know. Did he survive Law and Order UK?
No, he got shot. Okay. I'm sorry. That was years ago. I assumed you knew.
I think BBC America only aired the first few seasons.
Oh, no. I think in like season 3 or something of that. His character got killed off.
Oh, okay. No, they stopped airing it before that season because they switched out one of the chief barristers. And
that's right.
We had primarily been watching it for him because he was just he was just such a delightful jerk.
I've actually really enjoyed Law and Order UK. I'm not sure if they're making any more, but I mean, the stories were all based on original American Law and Order stories and just sort of, you know, adapted for UK lore and society and what have you. But they were, you know, so they were tried and tested stories, if you like.
Yes.
But the way it was done, I don't know. I really enjoyed it. It felt.
Yes.
I mean, notwithstanding that they had to make some, shall we say, modifications to the way real police actually operate in the UK. Because we don't have, for example, the sort of the twin detective setup here. You know, it's not a real thing in real life. And, you know, we don't have the sort of the lieutenant detective relationship that you have in America. But, you know, those things notwithstanding, the overall presentation was very British. You know, if you didn't know that it was based on Law and Order US, you could be forgiven for thinking that this was an original British show. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think it's a shame that they don't seem to be making any more.
And the casting was phenomenal. They did a wonderful job, especially in the early seasons.
Oh, we are a country full of wonderful character actors, so.
I know.
Buck Rogers.
You're right.
surely this is not an original observation.
You know, honestly, and shame on me, because I watched it as a small child in the 70s.
So did I.
And oh, that dumb Tweaky.
But yeah, when I was reading the write-up, I was like, so it's kind of Buck Rogers, but with a Star Trek type twist?
Yes, yeah. It's I think Buck Rogers assimilated a little more easily.
That's true.
So because a lot of this is and they really didn't go into this as much as they could have on the show, but a lot of this really was somebody coming at this with values that were hundreds of years old and having to adjust and vice versa.
Right, which wasn't, I mean, they made some comedy out of that in Buck Rogers, but it wasn't that much of a thing. You know, thinking about it, something else that I've just realized, we were talking about, you know, if this could have possibly fit into the Trek universe, but of course, in the Trek universe, time travel is, you know, a fairly well-known and well-established phenomenon. And whereas this is more of a Buck Rogers premise of we have one time travel event and then never again. Because, of course, if you could, he'd just go back in time. What's the problem? Just go back to your old utopian monarchy and live there.
I'm getting a little jaded about time travel. Which is a terrible thing to say, simply because it gets used as a reset button. With the Flash, they've been doing some time travel this in the past, and I'm hoping that it's just a tiny little seasoning and not a major element, because it's entirely too easy to hit a reset button and have only one person remember everything, and then then I don't feel like you're rewarding the viewer. For paying attention.
It is a very comics thing to do, though, isn't it?
Yes. I have no doubt it's probably available on file sharing, file ripping sites, but I don't use them. You know, I create content for a living, and so I'm very,
right.
very, very big on legally, you know, consuming your content.